Hello, dear internet strangers. Today is Friday, the 4th of August, and I am Kevin Carlson, joined by my co-host,
Steve Kubitz,
and we are talking in obscurity. Today, we have a double feature for you. At the Mountains of Madness, both the novella and the radio drama by H.P. Lovecraft and Dark Adventure Radio Theater.
Yeah, this was right up my alley, man. This is my wheelhouse. I love creepy stories, and I also love radio drama, so this really felt... I was really excited about this. Usually when it's a book you pick, I have to really hype myself up because you have awful taste. But with this one, I actually liked it.
It remind you of work?
It actually did kind of remind me of work. And I critiqued the radio drama very much like I was producing a segment.
It's like I wouldn't have gone with that.
Oh, I would have made that choice. And there's several things they do that I actually highly didn't like. We'll get into that later. But the producer part of my brain was like, oh, why would you do that? I felt like the person that did it did a good job. But I feel like they were trying really hard to be a little too authentic. But we'll get to that later.
Yeah. Overall, what did you think?
Oh, loved it. I mean, absolutely outstanding. I love both. I've read At the Mountains of Madness before, like just a book at some point in my life. Because if you like horror movies, inevitably you're going to get into Lovecraft. Like I feel like everyone that likes scary movies eventually goes through you go one of two ways. You either get into a really heavy Lovecraft phase, or you get into like a Stephen King phase.
I think I got into Lovecraft because of Stephen King. I'm definitely that person.
Which ain't no shame in that game either.
That's where I ended up. I think it was... Oh, man, I'm trying to remember the Stephen King novel where he even mentions Lovecraft. And that's what really, like...
Doesn't he mention him in it? Isn't it?
It may have been it.
Yeah, I think it is. I'm pretty positive it is.
It's also, like, 30 billion pages long.
Yeah, and it takes about 17,000 hours to get through it if you listen to an Audible.
Let's get back, like, focusing on...
On Lovecraft.
At the Mountains of Madness by Lovecraft. I found the radio drama, and I suggested it because I thought you would really like it, because I have a love for radio serials. I just love that technique, and this is not in the original at the Mountains of Madness, but in the radio drama by Dark Adventure Radio Theater. They have these fake ads, and all of these ads are for products that, like... It sounds like a real radio commercial, and they're for products that will absolutely kill you.
Yeah, it's like Chesterfield cigarettes, like Wilson's asbestos. And I actually found that was the part I, other than the story, which is incredible, I enjoyed the fake ads the most. Because it reminded me a little bit of, this is going to be a weird comparison, but I'm going to make it anyway. Remember Grand Theft Auto, Vice City, when you listen to the radio and there'll be all those cheesy fake ads for like, you know, hockey car dealerships and like strip clubs.
Yeah.
And they're very well done fake ads and they're very absurd. That's what these reminded me of. They're so like absurd, but they're only absurd because if you listen to like any kind of radio serials from the 20s and 30s all the way up to about the 50s, that's what radio sounded like.
Yeah.
Like it was all weird, quiche, like... And today's segment's brought to you by Chesterfield Cigarettes, the number one cigarette recommended by doctors. Like, it's just so absurd with our modern ear.
The Lone Ranger was a very different kind of feel on those stories.
Yeah.
Well, like any Lovecraft story, I love the atmosphere in At the Mountains of Madness. It's actually my favorite Lovecraft story. It is the story that I feel like inspired... Campbell's Who Goes There, which became The Thing.
Yeah.
I have my own personal pet theory, because they came out in the same magazine, just one after the other, that Campbell's story comes out after At the Mountains of Madness, and that's a story about shapeshifters who are aliens in Antarctica. And At the Mountains of Madness, which came out before either the year or 2 years before, is a story set in Antarctica with shapeshifting aliens.
Yeah, it's hard not to like think about that, because I thought about that a lot, especially reading the main book, not the radio serial. Is that I love The Thing, and we talked about how much I love the book too when we read it for the podcast. But it is hard not to go, dude. You didn't even. It's like, what's that meme of, hey, can I copy your homework? Sure, make it look a little different. Like that's pretty much the Lovecraft story versus Who Goes There. Yeah. It feels like he changed it just enough. And it's funny, because even when I was trying to sort of remember the story for this podcast, I absolutely got the character from The Thing in this story. I'm like, oh, MacReady, the pilot. You know, like, oh, wait.
Wait, no. Like, so, like, I really think that Who Goes There it was at least informed by The Mountains of Madness. Although I would say that if we're making a slight comparison with him, Campbell's version of characters are a little bit better than Lovecraft's characters.
Well, yeah, I think what also is a little different is in who goes there, they don't explain much, but you know it's an alien.
Yeah.
Like, that's pretty obvious that it came from space, and we don't know what it is, what it wants. We just know it came from space. This feels, it takes that sort of idea of an alien in the sense that, like, smaller alien, where it's alien to us because we don't know what, we can't comprehend it. But we also, it's this unknowable force. It just is a little more than the thing. This is going to be a weird pronoun.
The thing, that not the big T thing, but a small T thing.
Like, that's sort of how I interpret it a little bit, is that while At the Mountains of Madness is more of this sort of unknowable, almost supernatural component, where I feel like who goes there is much more of like, it's an alien.
Yeah.
You know, again, aliens can be supernatural because, I mean, they absolutely kind of are. But aliens also exist sort of in the, we don't know what space is. Mm. So it stands to reason there could be stuff out there we don't really understand. But Out of Madness, Madness is more of, there's whole universes we don't really understand and comprehend.
Yeah. I love his atmosphere of how this story goes. And like, it really actually got me interested in the various expeditions that have gone to Antarctica. Because a thing I like about Lovecraft's story, and it comes up in the novella, McMurdo Sound is the real actual port and station that they go to. That's a real place in Antarctica. I like that he in this story, this was the first time that like he really put a lot of research into what an actual Antarctica expedition is like. And like, this probably didn't rock your world, but like, I loved in the novel or novella version of this, we really explained the cutting edge technology of these drills and everything, because it showed a level of like, that was highfalutin technology in Lovecraft's day, and it shows that like he really did his homework to research this. A lot of his earlier stuff, he just kind of like, oh, and that guy is a scientist and he does science things. And
he winged it more often than not.
Yeah, and like, you know, especially like the professors from Miskatonic University come and they, you know, they just know shit. Like, he doesn't say it that way, but they like,
a little more elegantly he says it, but essentially that's what he says.
Essentially that's what he's going with. And in this, these people felt like they really did inhabit this world, and they really did prepare for this expedition, because he talks about the sledges they use, how many dogs they have, the airplanes they use, the drills, as I previously mentioned. I like the practical details in this. So it makes it feel more grounded in reality for whenever things suddenly go weird fast in the middle.
See, that's an interesting thing, 'cause that's kind of to piggyback with you a little bit. I felt like the attention to detail in this story is tremendous, either the story or the radio serial. Like, I liked the way in the radio version of this, when they almost qualify every statement with, I don't care if you believe this, because it's true. Mm-hmm. And people are going to think you're mad. Sure. Because when you're explaining something that's so ridiculous, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like, if you were telling somebody, yeah, I went to Antarctica, and it's all these ancient ones and the elder ones and these 6-foot-tall penguins, you know, blah, blah, blah. You would sound insane.
Yeah.
And I like the character's self-awareness to know, yeah, I'm going to sound insane. I don't care. This has to be told.
Yeah, I like that a lot of where his desperation of why they people can't go there, because it's hey, I don't know if that matters, if people go or not. Obviously, if you in this universe, if you go to Antarctica, you're looking to get killed horribly.
That's sort of the interesting thing about, you know, going to Antarctica and like the sort of fear in his voice. That's something I found very like, that's sort of true to what that experience would be. Because if you came back, you know, I'll give an example of my personal life. I went to the Dominican Republic recently. I had a great time. I'll tell everyone I had a great time. You should go there. It's amazing. However, if I went to, say, Antarctica,
yeah,
and saw 6-foot-tall penguins, weird Elder One creatures, and potentially the unknowable evil, I think that's what it's literally called.
Oh, yeah. Like, there's this this evil thing that, like, I think before we started, we talked about, don't look back.
Yeah, never, like, that's the thing about, like, I would tell people, hey, you should never go to fucking Antarctica, ever. Like, no one should ever go there. And if they go, what about the Starbucks there? Fuck the Starbucks, man. We don't need to be there anymore. It is such a universe where the way he tells it, you can absolutely buy the character in the radio serial. You can buy the fear in his voice. Whoever the voice actor was, I believed how afraid this dude was of what he saw and what he discovered and how he documented it and how it had to be told. Because originally, I love the detail of, we all agreed never to talk about it with anybody ever. And I'm breaking that pact because
they're sending another expedition.
It's too important not to.
You made me think of another thing that I liked about this era is whenever Lovecraft was writing this, Antarctica wasn't really explored yet. We had obviously not been to space. We didn't really. So nobody saw it from that angle. Nobody knew what was in Antarctica. So this impossibly tall mountain range, it obviously doesn't exist in reality. But in the era that this book came out, and this story originally came out, there could have been anything there. So, like, it really feeds into that, like, the fear of the unknown.
Yeah.
Because those, who knows if those mountains couldn't be there? Were you ever in Antarctica? Was anybody really in that direction? Like, there had been expeditions, but it wasn't very well charted yet. Like, I love, like, how it was still, it felt like a story where it was still a frontier in an age, even back then, where there weren't many frontiers left on the planet. But Antarctica was still a place that you could go, and nobody has seen this before.
It's kind of like how now you see a lot of things set either in space, because we don't know what's in space, or the other way, underwater, here. Where that's actually, I've always said this, I'm way more afraid of our ocean than I am space. Space never really scares me. Because to be honest with you, like, space is infinite. So, who knows? It's all potential out there. And to be honest with you, they ain't going to find us. No one's coming to the Florida of the galaxy. Like, I'm pretty sure aliens drive by Earth and lock their doors.
Like, ugh.
And, like, and don't lower your window, honey. We're driving by Earth. Like,
they're weird.
You know, but like, the ocean terrifies me to no end. Because I think I read somewhere, we've only discovered, like, 3%, roughly, 3-5% of ocean life.
Yeah, it's hard to do. And that's, like, in that era, it's hard to go to Antarctica. Because you'd freeze to death. And it took months to get there. You could only be there during certain seasons because it gets so cold.
Yeah.
I like that frontier element of this story.
Yeah, it felt very much like an explorer story. Like, you know, you think about how, like, if you read any book based on, like, California Gold Rush, you know, that felt like you were doing this sort of cool, exciting thing that no one's ever done before. And this book, both the radio serial and the actual book, feel like a team doing something that's never been done before. And the only problem is, when you do something that's never been done before, you don't know what to expect, and who's going to expect what they run into? Like, you know, I'll be honest, if a person said to me, I have a feeling we're going to run into really tall penguins,
I'd be like, what?
Danforth, stay home.
Like, what are you talking about?
Like, there's no way to ever expect what they're going to see on this sort of expedition. And I also love the sort of how, the thing about this book that I really enjoy is I feel like it, in a lot of ways, Lovecraft's writing reminds me of a song. Where you think about, like, the way songs are structured. You don't just start and dive in. You build up to it. It's like a, so everything in this story, but it is very much, it begins very, like, soft. Oh, it's about it. It's just these guys going on an expedition. It's cool. And then as it builds, it gets to the bridge where then it all of a sudden goes absolutely fucking nuts. And then it's inevitably, after everything's going crazy, it builds and builds and builds and builds. It gets to the crescendo of it, and then it goes back down, and the story sort of slows down as they get back to civilization. And it's a really cool sort of way to, it builds rhythm, in your, especially if you're reading it, where it sort of puts you in this sort of relaxed state, and then it takes that relaxation and fucking, like, makes your ears bleed.
That's actually a really interesting observation. You might not be aware of this because I'm a Lovecraft nerd and I've read biographies on him multiple times. It's what I do to relax. So Lovecraft's original love for writing, he wrote short stories when he was still in his juvenilia, when he was a very young man. But what he wanted to be was a poet. He was fascinated
With prose and
this type of form of poetry called Georgian poetry. And it was not based on an American in Georgia or anything like that, but like of an era of a English king. It's one of the Georgians.
Yeah.
So he was obsessed with this kind of like form, this poetry form, and I think that really did inform his writing. He eventually gave it up because it didn't really go anywhere, but I think that his fiction is informed by that. So like when you said it's sort of like a song, he does have that kind of rhythm to him. It's, you gotta like, the first time you read a Lovecraft story, it's a little difficult because it's so kind of arcane. But eventually, the more you read of it, it gets easier as you go.
Yeah.
The more you expose yourself to it, the more like you start thinking the way that he thinks. And it's interesting how it builds on itself.
It reminds me in a lot of ways of the first time I ever read Shakespeare. Where the first time I ever read Shakespeare, it seemed like, even though it was in English, it felt like a foreign language to me. Because it's like, what is this? Why is it this way? Like, it's so out of rhythm compared to how most fictional narratives are in the modern day. And this kind of felt that same vibe to me, where I'm reading it, in this case, why again, Audible. But, you know, you're still reading it, and it still feels like, what is this? Like, what person writes this way? Mm. But then by the time you get to the middle part of the story, it feels, why doesn't everyone write like this? Like, I don't mean that, like, I'm not trying to be like, this is great, because it's all, what I mean is, how it's amazing how, even though it feels very foreign at first, which also helps build the story, because it's supposed to feel foreign and alien, but when the writing feels kind of weird and strange, but then as you get into it, you start feeling like, oh my God, I get what he's doing. It's building, it's layered, it's such like a cool, it's honestly, the way I would describe his writing would be, do you remember, you ever played any of those like old rhythm video games where you try to match the thing and you can see the waves?
Yeah.
Or if you, and you kind of audio editing? It reminds me so much of looking at like an audio wave of just, it spikes, it goes down, it goes in low points, and it goes up, it goes around, and it sort of does this cool, trippy effect where it makes you, as you're listening to it or reading it, feel very off balance. And it almost makes you feel like your heart's beating out of rhythm.
Yeah, everything that he does in his writing, it's very deliberate. And I think that at this point in his career, he was very good at that. That's why I think this is his best story that he's ever done. How about we move on into our
dislikes
of this story? And this comes up with every Lovecraft story, really, is it's easy to forget the characters' names because they're plug and place.
They're placeholders.
You can put new people. The point of the story of a Lovecraft story is the atmosphere and the plot of what happens. The people. It is clearly not a character-driven narrative. Like, you can remember William Dyer because he's the one telling the story. Professor Lake, because bad things happen to that, but we'll put that more on the spoiler side whenever we analyze it more deeply. So, like, the characters are, they're just kind of there for unfortunate things to happen to them.
Yeah, and that's sort of exactly my, again, I don't want, piggyback on me too much, but to be honest, I completely agree. I think every character feels very one-dimensional. And it's hard for me because part of me thinks, okay, maybe it's kind of because they're men of their time. This book's set in the 20s. I'm not saying that there weren't multi, faceted men back then, but I'm sure scientists of the 20s weren't exactly like Mr. Personality.
Yeah.
So I can forgive that, but it still annoyed me because I felt like at times I'd be like, wait, who is this character again? Like, there's a reason that in my head I put the characters from The Thing into the story.
Because they were better characters.
Because they're better characters. And that's not to, like, disparage Lovecraft or anything like that. But it just felt to me at times, I'm like, oh, okay, like, I don't really care. Just get to the creepy bits. Which is never good when there's characters in a story. To me, it's almost the equivalent of when you're watching a slasher movie. You're like, okay, I don't care about this couple fighting and about to break up. Get to the killing bit.
Yeah, I want to see whenever everything goes askew.
like, which is fine, because to me that it's more atmosphere than it is character.
Yeah, I think you could speak better to this dislike, because we talked about how we shared it, but the static in the radio drama, like, it's intentional that it, because it's supposed to sound like a newscast of them actually in Antarctica, and there are times where I was like, I can't hear what's going on. I don't know. And like, I get what they're trying to do, but it is so overproduced that I'm finding myself just not liking this part.
So, as I've said before on this podcast, radio is my day job. And I, at times, when I was listening to the radio serial version, got so annoyed at the use of static, and also some of the use of when it was supposed to drop out, like, you know, picture like when a person's talking on like a two-way radio. Mm-hmm. You don't, it's never clear perfectly. It's always like, hello, my name is Steve. I'm here trying to find my way home. Mm-hmm. And that's cool. It builds ambiance. But it also, at times, you're supposed to hear, I'm trying to listen to a story. Mm-hmm. There are times where I have to rewind 20 or 30 seconds because I could not hear what a character was supposed to be saying or trying to say. And it felt very, you said overproduced. That's exactly how I would describe it. Whoever produced the radio serial really thought they were doing something cool by making it sound like an authentic, you know, 1920s radio broadcast, which is great. But I'm also, you can do a little static and you can build the same atmosphere without having to drown it out. So to me, that felt like, it actually took me out of the story more than it put me in the story, which is, to me, that's the kiss of death on production. If it makes you, if you start being aware that you're listening to something and not engrossed in it, that person has failed.
Yeah. I think that, especially in the sections where the blizzard's happening and like they're just yelling through static, I have no idea what just happened here. I know what's happening because I've read the novel so many times, but like in their conversation, like there are times where I was just like, I know what happens next. I got it.
And that's never a good... And I think that's probably my chief dislike of this, is that I'm not usually a stickler for, like... I'm kind of like in that way of, like, whenever an ex-player is, like, will be forgiven almost any sin a player commits on the ice or the field because, well, I've been there, I know exactly what that's... So I'm not usually that hard on production because I know it's hard. Mm. Like, actually producing things is difficult. And so... But this felt... Come on, man. I remember vividly, this is a throwback for me. When I was in college, I was supposed to produce a radio call-in show. So I was supposed to make it sound like, you know, people. So I did this really cool thing where I recorded the call-in bit on my phone. Because I thought, oh, it'll sound authentic because it'll be on the phone. It sounded like fucking dog shit. because my David Fabili, shout out, my main mentor in college, was like, I get what you're trying to do. Don't overthink it. Sometimes the simplest thing is just fix it in post. Mm-hmm. You can make something sound like anything with post-production. Mm-hmm. However, you can't fix that audio after the fact.
Once it's laid down, I mean, it is.
So that has stuck with me since 2010. Mm-hmm. And I felt like whoever did this production thought, oh, I know it sounds kind of rough, but that's going to be really cool because it's going to sound authentic. But the problem is it creates a situation where it really just kills the mood.
Yeah. I mean, as for the actual story, other than the characters, I really love this story. And so it's hard for me to, like, think of things I dislike about it. Other than, there is a thing that I like and dislike is, and I forgot to mention in my likes, is this is one of the first times Lovecraft shows a kind of empathy for characters that they're... Not to get too spoilery yet, but there are aliens in this, we could call them. I mean, although from their perspective, they'd been there longer than us, so...
Maybe we're the aliens.
That aside, strange alien-like creatures. He actually shows empathy for those creatures at one point, at least some of them. And for that kind of leap, that is... big thing for Lovecraft, because a lot of his earlier fiction had a little racist tinge to it. Well, not little, overt in a lot of but his earlier
stuff. Is it overt by today's standards or overt by 1920 standards, though?
Skirting the line.
That's always, I always wonder that, because like, it's hard. I always try to judge people by the era they were from.
Yeah.
But I do know he was pretty racist and pretty anti-Semitic.
Yeah, well, he did love this Jewish woman that was the only woman he ever really loved, which was weird. He kept that straight in his head.
Cognitive dissonance, baby.
Because his wife was... She actually left him. That's... I can't imagine why, but...
Yeah. He's a peach. Why would you want to leave that?
Why would you want to leave your anti-Semitic husband when you're Jewish? But he does have a moment where he sort of embraces the other, and that's like a big moment for him as a writer. The only thing that mars that, why there's a dislike, is he kind of like felt sorry for the people who kept slaves.
Yeah.
And I'm more on the slave side of this argument.
I'm going to say, here's a hot take. I will always be on the side of the slaves. Any story about slavers and slaves.
Yeah, I'm on the slave side of this argument.
I'm going to say, maybe it's a hot take, and I'm sure there's a Republican out there now, but what about the slave owners that lost their life? I'm sorry, but like, I'm 100% of the time, I'm on the slave side.
Yeah, like...
I felt the same way in Red Rising, and I feel the same way in this story.
It might be in this horrible shape-shifting monsters, but those horrible shape-shifting monsters did not ask to be made.
Nope, that is a great quote. I need that on a t-shirt. The horrible shape-shifting monsters didn't ask to be made.
Yeah.
Kevin Carlson.
It's kind of like an amalgam from Guardians of the Galaxy, but sure.
Yeah.
Like, but yeah, so I, on one side, I was like, oh, it's really cool of him that he shows empathy for another, finally, in his writing. But he kind of just went with the people who lost their slaves and the slaves revolted. And yeah, they are revolting in appearance. But if you had enslaved my species for, I don't know, countless millennia, I'd be all about ripping your head off.
You know what, though? They're gross looking. But so are pufferfish.
Yeah.
I wouldn't enslave a pufferfish.
What would you have a pufferfish do if you did?
Blow up balloons.
Okay, fair. Well, I think we should move on to the more spoiler side and really analyze it and get into it. Like, so, what happens on this expedition, in brief, is they go into Antarctica. It's a geological survey for the most part. They're exploring. That's why they have the drills and everything. And one of the professors, Professor Lake, who is not the main character, because, again, we're in the spoilers, Professor Lake dies a horrible death whenever he takes a splinter group off to investigate in a different direction. They find all of these bizarre fossils and these well-preserved organisms that look both like plants or maybe an animal. They're not sure what they are, but they're remarkably intact and tough. And they even dissect one of them. Well, so those things were the old ones, the elder things, or whatever you want to call them. And they weren't actually dead. They were just...
In stasis, basically.
In stasis, but yeah. They were just in stasis, and then they woke up, murdered everybody in the in that camp, because what would you do if you woke up...
To an autopsy?
To them cutting open your friends. I'd probably be mad at these little monkey creatures, too, that just were cutting me open.
I love the term monkey creature.
Yeah, well, like, you gotta think of it from the alien perspective.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm a giant starfish-headed thing with tentacles, and you just killed my friend Chip. I don't know why they have stupid names, but I'm gonna go with they have stupid names.
I feel like they would. Chip seems like a real, like, you think they're gonna be, like, really ridiculous names?
Yeah.
Like Zathoring or, like, but this is Chip.
That's Chip.
This is, Bill. Really?
Really? Very anglicized names.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We invented that language. You're welcome. But like that, I agree. I think that's so what I love about like that bit so much is that you always want to put yourself in the shoes of the antagonist, I guess, in their case. I would say the old ones are the antagonists.
Sort of, yeah.
In this sort of case.
From the human
perspective, yeah. But I love the idea that from their perspective, they're just vibing in their little Antarctic home.
Yeah, well, they got trapped out
because
their home is actually at the Mountains of the Madness, and there's a whole city there.
Yeah.
And they must have got trapped in a blizzard or what, a cave-in, and they went into stasis, and they woke up to thousands of years later, and there are these creatures that used to be their pets slash slaves, ripping them open.
Yeah, like, I would be pretty mad too. So I think that's the thing that, like, is cool, is that from... I love stories, and I always talk about this, where the monster, whatever you want to call it, isn't evil.
Yeah.
It just is. Like, I find so, like, much in stories that I find boring are when it's just, the monster's evil because he's evil. Mm. That's, okay, cool. Like, I kind of prefer, I like my monsters, they're just being, they just are. There's no, it's the same reason why I find, like, underwater, like, monsters so cool. It's because from... They're not evil. There's nothing, like, there's nothing malicious about them.
Yeah.
They're not doing anything.
They're just animals doing what they do.
They're not, like, none of the elder ones, or what are old ones, I can't remember the exact what they're called, but they're not doing anything other than defending themselves from their perspective.
Yeah.
So they're not evil. Like, they're not evil in the same way that if you were taking a nap, mm-hmm, and you woke up to someone trying to cut you open and you punch them in the face, are you evil? Maybe from the person trying to cut you open's perspective. But in general, I would say if you're not really that, maybe that's kind of their fault.
Yeah, I mean, and this is, like, a really cool shift that Lovecraft does, is because, like, it's towards the end of the story where he does this thing where he, like, thinks about it. The chief character, William Dyer, who's telling the story, thinks about, like, well, from their perspective, what we did to them was kind of really fucked up. And, like, and these poor things woke up after the stasis. They go back to their city after they murdered those monkey things that were trying to kill them. And they find that their whole civilization was wiped out. And that's going to be a very unfortunate thing to find out. They go back home and their civilization declined, got into war with their slaves, which were the Shoggoths. And that's where you kind of lose me on, like, oh, we should feel bad for the old ones. I'm like, oh, well, they had
these. Do we, though?
We have to feel bad for them because they did create this other species that were these shape-shifting bubble monsters. Then that... And they made them do all the terrible work. And they made them... They were, you know... Did anything slave-like. And so when... The actual horror of it is whenever Dyer and Danforth go and investigate this city that they just find in the mountain range whenever they fly over it. And, like, that moment when they're first going over the mountain range and they can't accept what they're looking at isn't natural until they realize that's a city.
Yeah, someone built it. Like,
something built that city, and it wasn't humans. And it's been here for millions of years, way longer than there has been a humanity. That turn in the late middle story is possibly the best effect in my mind. Is, like, just what, as they're flying towards it and they're trying to, like, reason, like, well, that could be some sort of, like,
Natural
formation. But whenever they finally get over it and say, nope, that's a city.
There's little buildings, there's little, like, yeah, like, little houses. Like, I think what's cool about that as an effect is that you, like, especially if you're a person that's sort of scientifically driven, everything's one way until it absolutely isn't.
Yeah.
And there's no way to ignore what your eyes are seeing. Mm. And I find that part of the story just amazingly interesting. Because overall, I think back to, like, if, you know, think about when you're a kid and you're exploring, like, your backyard and you're going to the woods or something and you find little creatures, you're like, you're, for the first time, you're not taught this yet. You don't, it's not like you know, oh, this is this kind of bug. Mm-hmm. So you're just exploring. Like, there's something very human about the idea of wanting to explore. Now, me, I'm a coward. So my instinct's always to go the opposite way of people are going.
Are you saying that you wouldn't want to go explore the necropolis that you just found in the Antarctica?
So I'm going to tell you right now, this is my motto in life and why I will always survive. Not my problem. And, like, well, aren't you curious about the, you know, no. You know why? It's the phrase is curiosity killed the cat. Not curiosity awarded the cat with a Nobel Prize. Like, so, I'm good. There are certain things it's good not knowing.
Would you even go on the expedition to the Antarctica?
Oh, no. I would definitely not. My name would not be on the sign-up sheet.
Yeah, you wouldn't be one of the graduate students or... I'm imagining Professor Kubitz at Miskatonic University. Oh, we're going to Antarctica to explore for the first time.
You are going to Antarctica. I'm not. Like, and then in my version of the story where I'm being interviewed by the radio guy, I go, I smoke a cigarette. I told him not to go.
It's cold.
It's cold. Why would I go there? I'm missing out at university. Just living my life. Smoking Chesterfield cigarettes. Like, like, that's what I would be doing. And I'd be like, I told him not to go. They're stupid. Like,
glad they did.
I'm glad all of them are gone. I got tenure now. Made my career, like.
Much easier for progression in your university track.
When everyone else dies. Yeah, but like, no, but all, but all seriousness, like, I do really vibe in terms of like the story narrative of how you can't. Well, you talked about this the other night, actually, funny enough. If one thing ridiculous is real and you can see with your own eyes, mm-hmm. all bets are off. Anything's possible. The moment you see a multi-million-year-old city that predates humanity, then everything else in the story feels like it could... Why wouldn't it be? Why wouldn't there be these absurdly large blind penguins that are sort of like almost human-like the way they walk?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't that be there? Why wouldn't there be these weird winged like bat creatures, you know, that are, you know, the elder one? Why wouldn't that be there? Well, of course. Like, if anything's possible, then everything's possible.
Yeah, and like I think that you can really feel the ground shifting under you if you're putting yourself in the mind space of this story. Like, the effect works so well because he grounds it very much in reality with when I was talking about how he did his research with the drills and the equipment that they took to Antarctica. It all feels like a real expedition to Antarctica. Everything's firmly set in reality. And then all of a sudden, there are horrible monsters that predated humanity when they had cities and they had slaves. And these things are shape-shifting slaves. And, like, everything is... You can feel what you thought was the solid earth underneath of you just cracking open and falling away and realizing you know nothing.
Well, that's the thing that's so cool about this story is that these are all really intelligent, you know, they're men of science. So they're the smartest people, presumably, that we have, or among the smartest people we have. But so Matt, how would you feel if you think you have a firm idea of how evolution works, you have a firm idea of how carbon dating works, you have a firm idea of sort of the rough outline of humanity, but then all of a sudden, on your planet, we know nothing. We not only are we incorrect in some assessments, we're incorrect in everything of what our planet is. Mm. Imagine how earth-shattering that would be.
Yeah, I mean, it is aptly named At the Mountains of Madness because the ideas that come up in this story are, it's chaos, it's madness. That is, and it's reflected in how some characters go mad whenever confronted with this. And it's just the idea of that everything that you took for granted might not be true anymore. Everything. That we are the supreme species on this planet, that this, we know where we came from. I love the little detail of, like, the Elder Things may have created humanity as a joke.
Yeah, there's, which, imagine, what's crazy, I think about this, I thought about this listening to this story a lot, is that, so if you're a person, and this is probably true, I would wager in the 20s, it's still true today, a lot of people believe in God. Mm. The idea of a creator, you know, one single creator. Imagine if you were faced with the idea of, maybe we were created by these things. Not only is it not a single entity God, mm-hmm. we could just be a creation that's sort of like just by a complete just, created humanity, sure.
Just to see.
Just see what happens. Like, that would be, the only thing I compare it to, and this is really stupid, is in the DC comic storyline, The Doomsday Clock, mm-hmm. where you learn that the whole DC universe was created by Dr. Manhattan when he decided to create, at the end of Watchmen, he says, I'm going to go create some life of my own. And then every character, Superman and Batman, learn that not only is that this is God, essentially, but he created it because he just wanted to see what would happen.
Yeah, and that's kind of what it's Lovecraft always has you face in all of his stories. It's not just that The Mountains of Madness, where there are these terrible, powerful, insane beings of immense power so beyond our scope that it's like an ant trying to not comprehend just a human, trying to comprehend a city that humans have built. And like, the scale makes no sense of how big and how extreme these things are. Because the Elder Things, whenever Danforth and Dyer are going through the city, they're going through their entire history, which apparently they could do a lot of paintings for that. Like, I love the novel detail of, like, they could tell all of this by just looking at pictures.
Yeah.
Those were some great picture making things.
Yeah, which is, they probably had a really talented slave do all the drawing.
So, the elder things had wars, and they had things that they didn't like to talk about and that they were afraid of. And I like to think about that for a second. Oh yeah, we don't go over there because there's something really awful over there.
Well, it's like, what scares the boogeyman?
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you're scared of this thing, and what the hell scares that thing? Which means, oh my God. Like, not only are these not the be-all end-all of sort of, I use evil in like the way we would describe it.
Yeah.
But that means there's something beyond that. And of course, you eventually learn, I believe it's Cthulhu, right? He's kind of the...
Yeah. They strongly imply that it's...
The ancient evil is Cthulhu, right? Like, it's not...
They have a war with the Cthulhanoids, whatever that means. But and there's also this implication of, like, how many levels are there beyond this? Is it just there, or are there even more beyond that?
And are there other planets?
Like, what's going on?
Where these people live, where these things live? The thing about this story that I find so cool is that when you think about it, it really asks, despite being, if you're listening to the audible version, the book's 4 hours long. The radio serial is like, what, 2 hours, if that?
Yeah.
6 hours total. But it makes you ask big, big questions. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible to me that such a short story, in the grand, how we look at, like, I mean, I know it's sort of like a novella kind of thing, but it really makes you sort of existentially question, what would this mean in our reality?
Yeah.
If these kind of things happened, how would that break us? Because it absolutely would. We're not good with people that are just slightly a different shade of white than us. You think we'd be good with the idea of, oh, not only are we fundamentally wrong in terms of how we look at religion, we're wrong in how we look at everything ever.
Yeah, and that the things that may have created us might not even be the biggest players in the universe. They might not even be beyond the minor leagues in the overall universe. Because it implies a lot of the times that these things, well, ancient to us, really kept their heads down compared to other things out there. Because they just have, like... And it sort of implies that the natural order of all cosmic-level entities and civilizations are violence against each other. Like, not understanding, just... whenever you encounter another alien life, it's so alien, the only approach to it is to try to eradicate it.
Well, it sort of also, to me, makes you sort of loosely realize that we look at sort of cosmic horror as all kind of interlinked. Mm. You know, I remember reading 14. You know, those big creatures are all linked to the bigger creature. They're all kind of in the same
thing. They're all on the same team,
yeah,
if you will.
I like this story how there's no teams.
Yeah.
Like, there's no, like, one team. It's sort of, like you said, if you see a thing that looks different, you just destroy it. And I like the idea, the implication that these sort of elder ones were just like, please don't be destroyed, please don't be destroyed. It's like when you're walking in to a restaurant or a bar and you run into your ex-girlfriend and you're like, please don't look at me, please don't look at me, please don't look at me. That's kind of what the sort of they're doing, is they just want to be hidden, they want to do their own thing and not really be, don't draw attention to yourself.
Yeah.
Because if you draw attention to yourself, that's how you get killed. And that also is kind of terrifying, because that means that what if one of these things came to Earth and saw us?
I think that, like, a lot of Lovecraft's point about, like, the universe and space and everything is we should keep our heads down. Because whatever we meet out there is probably not going to be friendly. Which is a very pessimistic view of things. It's interesting. I mean, I love Lovecraft's fiction, but I'm a big Star Trek person, too. That I like that finding common ground. So I'm really torn on this, because I love these kinds of stories, because I love the atmosphere of it. But I also like the idea that, like, not everything out there will be awful.
Not everything wants to kill you.
Yeah, like, I like to believe that because you've ascended so far to have this sort of technology or the natural ability to go beyond your home planet, that would enlighten you to a certain degree to be more empathetic to the other life that shares.
How could it not, honestly?
Yeah, I mean, so I think there's something to be said for that too, but I find his view very compelling. What if it isn't? What if we're wrong? It's the last mistake we make as a species.
That's a really cryptic way to... And that's kind of true, because I think that's sort of probably the best place to end is that. That's probably the best place to end on this, because that's the biggest question. What if our optimism is misguided?
Yeah.
And what if we decide to venture out and explore? And not only are they not friendly, but they're absolutely malicious. And not in the sort of good and evil way of malicious, where like a person like kicks a puppy, but in a way that
we want to move over there. You're in the way.
Honestly, that's the thing, man. Like if you can't comprehend it, what's that quote? What's a king to a god? What's a god to a non-believer? Mm-hmm. It's sort of like do you ever think about if you step on an ant, you ever feel guilty about it?
That's exactly what I was going to go.
Do you ever, like, if you are walking downtown and you step on an ant, do you then think, I really can't believe I killed that ant. I feel so bad. You probably never think about it again.
If the wasp built a nest on your porch, do you think about the ramifications of the wasp before you wipe them out?
No. And I think that's the scariest part about this story, is that from their perspective, they're not going to think about you because you're nothing to them. And that doesn't mean that they're inherently evil. It just means that they're above our comprehension. And that's actually, to me, way scarier than they're just evil.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that we're the wasps on their galactic porch, and they do not want to deal with us. They don't want to enrich us. Could you imagine trying to enrich wasps?
What's that? Sometimes you're the bug, sometimes you're the windshield.
Yeah. So, on that depressing note, I think that'll conclude this podcast. And Steve, what are we going to listen to next? It's your pick.
So I had an internal debate of what I wanted to pick. There was a couple. I actually almost picked the 1920 Superman radio serials. But I didn't really. I listened to it. I wasn't crazy about some of the production choices too. So I don't want to be annoyed again. So I'm not going to do that. So my pick is going to be Henderson the Rain King by Saul Bellow.
Okay.
It's, if you're a Counting Crows fan out there, it's the book that inspired the song Rain King. So it's one of my favorite. That's my absolute favorite band. And this is the lead singer of that band, Adam Duritz, his favorite book. So I'm excited to dive in. I've not read it since college, so I'm excited to sort of reread it and sort of analyze it for the podcast.
I'm looking forward to it. All right. Well, you'll hear from us next time.